We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning and happy Wednesday. It is Wednesday, December 4th, and we are starting with a very important case that if you haven't heard about this yet, you need to know about, that will be argued today at the U.S. Supreme Court. It is, at least according to the docket, the only oral argument that is taking place, and so you can listen to the live stream, and if you have time, I would encourage you to do that and listen to that at supremecourt.gov or C-SPAN airs it, but you can listen to the full argument online. And this is a case, it's United States versus Scrimeti. And the question is whether the Tennessee Senate Bill 1, which prohibits all medical treatments intended to allow a minor to identify with or live as a purported identity inconsistent with the minor's sex, or treat that purported discomfort or distress from a discordance between the minor's sex and asserted identity, that's the Tennessee statute, violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So this is really a case that for the first time, the U.S. Supreme Court is going to directly hear a case on point related to the mutilation of children through this whole transgender movement nonsense and hormone therapy. And there are about 20 other states that have similar laws. And the American Family Association has filed an amicus brief in this case. And so joining me to discuss the import of why we here at AFA are concerned about this, obviously, and why you should be too and paying attention to this, is our very good friend Abraham Hamilton III, who is also general counsel here at AFA. Good morning, Abe, and thank you so much for stopping by on a very important, I think, red letter day for our country.
Good morning, Jenna. It's a privilege to be with you.
Yeah, so this case, you know, that is being heard by the U.S. Supreme Court, tell us the kind of how it came to the Supreme Court and why this is so important.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line, and you set up the case posture very well. The state of Tennessee made the decision after learning that children were being mutilated and being provided, you know, chemically castrating medication, drugs, and the name of transgenderism. The state legislature and its citizens via its legislature enacted a law prohibiting those procedures and those practices from being imposed upon children, you know, and it's well within the state's prerogative to protect its minor citizens from things of that nature. But it's interesting to me that this has occurred, that the United States Department of Justice under the Biden-Harris administration intervened in the case and even manufactured that 14th Amendment equal protection argument to prohibit states from being able to protect its minor citizens from this type of insanity. And so the state of Tennessee succeeded at the lower court, and the United States has appealed the matter to bring it before the United States Supreme Court. And so that is how we've landed at this particular juncture. And simply put, I know we're going to get into this in more detail. The issue that is before the court is whether or not states have the lawful authority to protect its minor citizens from this insanity. What's happening in Tennessee will have outsized impact upon whether or not other states will be able to do just as Tennessee has done in protecting its minor citizens.
Yeah, and this is such an important case because, as you rightly say, Abe, this will have an outsized impact on the entire country. I mean, this is really no different than, what Obergefell versus Hodges, the same-sex marriage decision, said to the full country, Roe versus Wade, and then ultimately Dobbs overturning that said to the full country. But that begs the question, should the U.S. Supreme Court, under an equal protection theory, which, as you and I would agree, is totally nonsensical. But before we get into the merit or lack thereof of that argument, should the U.S. Supreme Court be deciding this for all states?
that question is an obviously appropriate question. Simply put, the U.S. Supreme Court was never promulgated to be the ultimate arbiter of all state matters. You know as well as I know, Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 78 described the judiciary as having neither force nor will, as being the least threatening to the liberty of the individual and of the states. But because, frankly, of the fecklessness of Congress, first of all, and secondarily because of the hyper-litigious penchant with which many people in our society, if you can't win by persuading your neighbor and persuading your state legislature, then you try to sue for everything. We've gotten to this place to where we have an outsized comprehension on our federal judiciary. And it's jolting for people to hear me say this. Most people are taught that our federal government consists of co-equal branches of government. But that's not what the Constitution creates. We have a system of checks and balances, but not a system of co-equal branches. They each have their roles to play, but their roles are not equally potent. They are checks and balances upon each other, but they don't have the equal potency as it pertains to domestic life versus foreign affairs and things of that nature.
Yeah, so well said. And invoking my man, Alexander Hamilton, he is one of my favorite among the founders for what he wrote in The Federalist. And of course, you know, we could get off on a tangent on that. But absolutely, you're 100% right. And yet we have this case that is now pending today before the Supreme Court. And what's very fascinating about this is that the left is somehow trying to invoke a sort of restrained, limited state action theory to say, well, you know, the state shouldn't be able to tell parents, you know, what supposed health care, quote unquote, they can get for their kids. Well, isn't this the exact same, you know, left that's trying to say that, you know, parents have no rights at all? And didn't they just tell a dad in Texas that he can't actually stop his son from gender mutilation and they foreclose all parental rights as to him? I mean, this is such a hypocritical position for the left, but they bend themselves into pretzels and they're either for parents or against parents or for babies in the womb or against them or, you know, all kinds of things, whether or not it just fits their preferred outcome.
That's absolutely right. There's no consistency to the logic or the legal arguments. It's simply what I prefer. And that is what's being argued in this case. When you ask the question whether or not the court should be involved here, it's clearly a matter, specifically the U.S. Supreme Court, it's clearly a matter, even if you have parents in the state of Tennessee who are objecting to Tennessee's law, that this is a matter that should be resolved in the state of Tennessee. The reason why you have the notion elevated to the federal judiciary is because of the United States Department of Justice. The DOJ intervened in the case and manufactured really a false equal protection argument for no other reason than to remove the matter away from the state of Tennessee, to get it into the federal judiciary, and to allow them to intervene as an active party in the case, meaning the federal Department of Justice. And I don't think people understand just how egregious this is. You have a matter that's being handled at the state level where the constitutional separation of powers rightly diagnoses that this should take place. Then you have the federal government saying, no. We want to play, and we want to actually play on our turf, so we want to take it out of the state and bring it into the federal court system so that we can have the matter brought to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I know sometimes we can get kind of jaded when we start thinking about eyes kind of glaze over, we start talking about process and things of this nature. But to have a federal government that will do that, combined with what you rightly diagnose, this inconsistent logic to where parents have rights when we want them to have rights, but parents don't have rights when we don't want them to have rights, it all comes back to the fundamental reality is that they don't really care about what's constitutional or lawful. What they are mostly concerned about is their really whacked out regressive ideology being accepted without any opposition throughout our country.
So well said. And so what are they actually arguing? The ACLU, and this was really fascinating to me to learn that the American Civil Liberties Union, their attorney, who is arguing on behalf of the Tennessee parents, will be the first openly transgender lawyer to argue in the Supreme Court. So they are even going so far as to have their own counsel be the face of their whacked out, as you say, ideology. What are they actually arguing in terms of an equal protection theory?
Yeah, and that the representation is truly a representation of the legal argument. They're attempting to make the argument that because this gender identity ideation, shoehorning that into a protected class status argument, trying to say that because they are a protected class, they're not saying that overtly, but basically making that argument that they should be treated as a protected class, then they should have the equal protection of the laws, that because of their protected class status, then they should be allowed to do whatever they want based on that status. And what the state of Tennessee is saying is that, no, this, first of all, there's no protected class concerning gender ideation. And secondarily, we're not picking and choosing who can and can't get treatment. We're saying no minors can get this. This is not about anything having to do with your identity, your personal ideation, your personal view of how you see yourself. And the proponents of, or should I say the opponents of Tennessee's law, even had to admit that even the science is on the side of the state of Tennessee, because they recognize that children who struggle with dysphoric ideations at younger ages, if you just leave them alone, they normally end up working out just fine. The data, the science, and the law is all on the side of the law. And so to assert that this is a equal protection violation really is an absurdity, and I would say, frankly, an assault on our constitutional understanding of what it means to have equal protection under the laws.
Absolutely. You are so right. And to create these fictional classes of persons, this was never what any notion of civil rights or even human rights, and certainly not, you know, liberty and freedom, was ever intended to be. When we talk about natural rights and we talk about things like protecting and true equal protection, and when we're talking about things like even civil rights, like non-discrimination against the sexes, well, there are only two, and that is right. Natural. When you talk about parental rights, that flows from a natural union of one man and one woman, where in principle, that is the only union that even has the possibility of producing a child. And so when we talk about natural rights, everything that the left wants to fictionally manufacture must have some kind of unnatural component for it to exist and persist. And so they're creating all of these fictional classes that have no basis in natural law. Everything is unnatural. And so they are manufacturing this whole idea of civil rights as opposed to natural rights. And I see this as a growing movement on the left to just create out of nothing, basically, this totally fictional world that goes against logic, it goes against science, it goes against everything, and to force that onto the American people through law and process, which really undercuts the very idea and the fulcrum of what law itself is supposed to protect.
You're so right. And when you factor in, and I know you and I have discussed this before, the study that the American taxpayers paid for, conducted by the gender clinic director from California, that showed during a study of whether or not, you know, giving these kind of hormone blockers and all these things to children actually aids them in processing their mental health statuses, there is documented evidence, not just around the world, in our own nation, that it doesn't do anything to aid that. And your point about the effort to create a fictionalized reality in order to assert their ideology, it's exactly what it is. It's the modern iteration of Did God Surely Say? You know, in order to assert some of these absurd notions, you have to detach from reality. You have to obscure what is factual. You have to eclipse what is truth. And that is what's attempting to happen. We as people, if you zoom away from all the legalese and the court proceedings and things of that nature, we know as people that children do and choose things that probably isn't the best for them in many instances. You know, if you abide by their logic, you know, my second youngest son, for the longest, I tell people all the time, he was convinced that he was Spider-Man. He didn't just like Spider-Man. He was convinced that he was Spider-Man. I would come home from work, he'd go, psst, psst, dad, webbed you, you know. Now, what kind of father would I be? And I say, okay, son, since you're Spider-Man, go ahead and jump from upstairs, swing from the rafters, let me indulge your view of yourself. What would be the result? Everybody knows. Not only will my son be harmed, but I'll be hauled off for negligence and abusing my own children. Yet we have the federal government attempting to intervene to say a state cannot protect its own minor citizens and protect its own minor citizens from greedy medical clinicians, people who are willing to sacrifice children on the altar of their ideology. And to have the federal government to tell a state that you can't do so is an absurd and an egregious violation of our system of federalism, and it defies all logic, not to mention that it contravenes the truth of what's provided for us in Scripture, that the least of these need to be protected from the insanity of adults.
Yeah, so well said. And it just defies common sense that to say that the state can't restrict parents from choosing to mutilate their children, because the state already can impose penalties for intentional, even temporary bodily harm. We call that abuse.
Yes.
And this is permanent abuse. And it's even heightened. And so to somehow suggest that this doesn't fall within the scope of a legitimate state policing power. I mean, obviously you have a natural tension between the state and parental rights, but this is where we have totally obliterated the notion of even what a parent means, and even what a child means when we talk about, you know, abortion and, you know, some of those things where, oh, personhood doesn't attach until this arbitrary line. But this is how we get to the utter confusion that is this case. So what did AFA argue?
Yeah, we argued in more professional terms than what I'm articulating right now, simply put, that states have the lawful authority to protect minors from transgender insanity. There's nothing in the law that prohibits adults from pursuing this. When the child gets to the age of the majority, they'll have the wherewithal to do whatever they want to do to their bodies, whether it's, you know, taking medications or whatever they want to do. But the law simply says that children cannot do that. Our basic argument is that states have the lawful authority to protect children from assisted self-harm. That's the bottom line of what we're arguing. And we appeal to natural law reasoning, as you pointed out. We appeal to scientific data, and we appeal to the scriptures in our argument. And we were joined in our amicus brief by state legislators from every other state that has a law similar to Tennessee's in our brief before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Excellent. And this is why, for everyone who donates to AFA and who helps in this ministry, this is part of what you are helping. And so your voice is being heard through this amicus filing. And we thank you for your support for this ministry, because this is such important work. And so, Abe, of course, you know, nobody can predict the outcome. And there's a lot of people who try. But I'm going to ask you that question anyway. Mm-hmm. With the current composition of the U.S. Supreme Court, obviously, we know what we hope the outcome will be, but are you concerned at all, given, for example, just, you know, the Bostock opinion, which was, you know, right, Gorsuch, who should be a conservative, changed the definition of sex, meaning sexual orientation, gender identity, as listeners might recall, in the Civil Rights Act. And so, you know, we've gotten some bad decisions from the Supreme Court, even since its composition has changed to be what I would call really, though, a 3-3-3 mm-hmm. split. It's not really conservative. What is your best prediction?
Yeah, I mean, Bostick always is an outsized concern. And really, the opponents to Tennessee's law trying to really shoehorn a Bostock reasoning, frankly, into this case. But when it comes to the reality of medication and the permanence of these procedures, I wouldn't be surprised if Gorsuch joined a majority in upholding Tennessee's law. I'm certainly hopeful for that outcome, but I'm always very cautiously optimistic. I'm not certain where Justice Amy Coney Barrett will land on this, but don't be surprised if you have one. Maybe Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson might even uphold Tennessee's law. Now, I'm not holding my breath for it, but I would not necessarily be surprised if she upheld Tennessee's law. There were some decisions she's made in other cases that gives me an indication that isn't necessarily outside of potential the potential conclusion, but I am hoping for, and I do expect Tennessee's law to be upheld. I'm just interested to see how they would articulate that. It would be a broadside to our nation for Tennessee's law to be held to be unconstitutional, because that would also invalidate other states' efforts to protect minors from the same insanity. So I would encourage listeners to pray for our nation, to pray for the justices, and pray for the truth of the word of God, frankly, to prevail in our nation, because to have a society that will say that not even minors can be protected from this insanity is something that really is unfathomable on so many levels.
Yeah, so well said. And I would echo that encouragement, because this is why I say this is a red letter day in our country, because if we have the highest court in the land saying that a state cannot protect its minor citizens from this kind of horrific abuse, then what does that say about the status of morality in our society and what we are willing to codify into law, or where we are willing to go to twist and contort the U.S. Constitution and the rights that should be upheld, that are natural and, as we know, flow from God and our identity in Him alone, and our entire cultural understanding of human beings, anthropology, human sexuality. I mean, this touches on so many different areas of truth, and we must pray for that. So Abraham Hamilton III, I so appreciate it. And thank you so much for dropping by. And listeners can listen to the oral argument today. It'll start at 10 a.m. and you can listen at supremecourt.gov or C-SPAN, or probably anywhere that it's streaming online. But I would encourage you to take the time, if you can, to listen to it, whether it's live or later, just so that you are informed of what is actually being argued, what questions the justices pose, and know for yourself what's going on. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Could the fate of America's children be tied to the fate of our nation itself? Much like the abortionists who end the lives of the unborn, the left is determined to undermine the pro-life movement. First, they target the babies. Then they come for the rest of us. Preborn stands as a beacon of hope for the most defenseless among us, preborn babies. Every day, Preborn's network of clinics rescue, on average, over 200 babies while surrounding expectant mothers with God's love and offering a free ultrasound. Rescuing the miracle of life has never been more crucial as we navigate this time of moral decline in our nation. Will you join Preborn in protecting the least among us? For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound and give a mother the chance to choose life, not only for her baby, but for herself. An ultrasound doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR. Preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we are still talking about the monumental case that the Supreme Court is going to hear today at about 10 a.m. And so there is a rally going on at Capitol Hill, and Mary Margaret Olihan, who has been covering this case extensively as a senior reporter for The Daily Wire, joins us now. And Mary Margaret, I want to talk to you about a little bit about the history of this case, because it originated, of course, in Tennessee with the governor signing Senate Bill 1 into law in March of 2023. It went into effect last year. And the bill actually followed a really extensive investigation into Vanderbilt by The Daily Wire's Matt Walsh. So explain that impact on the whole history of how we got here.
Absolutely. And good morning, Jenna. So Matt Walsh did this investigation into Vanderbilt Medical University Center, and he found that this medical center was pushing transgender procedures on kids and describing them as quote-unquote big money makers, which is just incredibly disturbing on multiple levels. But the investigation exposed to Tennesseans and to Americans at large how serious this gender ideology cult has become, and how much these groups and doctors and activists are investing into this issue. And so we even had Tennessee lawmakers saying this week that they were inspired by Walsh's investigation to introduce the legislation that is at the heart of this Supreme Court case today. So obviously at the Daily Wire, we're really invested in this case, you know, partially because Walsh had such a big role in it, but also because this could mean a very, very historic thing for so many Americans, so many kids across the country who might be pushed down this path by activist doctors or therapists or teachers without federal protections and without this Supreme Court case siding with parents and saying, no, you can't be pushing your kids down this path. We're not going to be pushing that ourselves.
Yeah, and Matt Walsh has said that this case could have a Dobbs-style effect on the country. And I was actually listening to Morning Wire ahead of the show, and you did a phenomenal report on this case on Morning Wire. And the clip that Matt Walsh was playing that he commented was saying that, you know, parents, of course, don't, and doctors don't have the right to mutilate children's bodies. And it's, in fact, children who have a human right, who have a natural right to intact bodies. And the fact that, yeah, and I mean, and the fact that anyone is even arguing to the contrary is just inexplicable to me.
Exactly. I mean, we have the ACLU at the court today. They're going to try and argue that this is discrimination against kids. They're going to try and argue that this is denying parents the rights to help their kids the way they wish. They kind of want to accuse conservatives of being hypocrites. But like you were saying, and like Walsh pointed out, there are some things that parents should not have the right to do for their kids, such as put them on irreversible hormones or puberty blockers or through irreversible surgeries that they're absolutely going to regret later in life. So that's not an argument that I think the justices are going to be super interested in. And when it comes to the sex discrimination argument, that's where the ACLU will try and say, well, you know, doctors can give, you know, a young boy testosterone, so why can't they give it to a girl? And obviously, I think anyone with a brain would say, well, because a girl isn't supposed to have that much testosterone, it's going to have very serious negative effects on her body. So those will be really interesting arguments to follow.
Yeah, and as we mentioned in the first segment, the ACLU attorney is actually a woman who has gone through some trans, you know, medical transition herself, and so she appears as a man, but her voice still sounds very feminine. I mean, if you didn't look at the appearance, I mean, it's very obvious that that she is a woman, and it is making the case somehow that this is sex discrimination if doctors aren't allowed to mutilate children's bodies. And I really hope that at least one of the justices just asks the question, not only what is a woman, you know, maybe on behalf of Matt Walsh, but also says, okay, aren't there only two genders, and how on earth is this somehow sex discrimination?
Absolutely, and I'm sure you can hear in the background, Jenna, we just arrived at the court, so it is already bumping this morning. We've got tons of pro-trans protesters and then a lot of family advocates and people who are pushing to protect kids here, so it's a little, that's why it's loud in the background, that's what it is. But
no problem.
Yes. This ACLU lawyer, Chase Strangio, that's a woman who identifies as a man, and she's here. She's arguing for kids to be able to undergo the same procedures that she herself went through to try and appear more like a man. But interestingly, she went through these procedures when she was 20, according to reports I've heard. So, you know, I think that could potentially be an argument against what she's saying, and that maybe we should teach kids a little longer. If you're going to try and force them down this path, they might deserve at least more than their, maybe give them their adolescence to grow up.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is definitely a moral difference in terms of what the state protects when you're talking about a 20-year-old or an adult making stupid decisions for themselves versus parents and doctors making life-altering decisions for children when they are helpless to have their own input and decide. I mean, it's a completely separate question, and I hope that the justices get there. But Mary Margaret, you've said that you're at the court now. Describe what you're seeing there, and you mentioned there are some, you know, trans-affirming protesters and all of that. What is kind of the scene there?
Yeah, so there's a lot of media here. There's a lot of activists and protesters. We're seeing a big group. Usually, this is typical for these protests. On the right, you got the leftist activists, and on the left, you have more of the pro-family ones. But it's still early. This protest just got started, so I think we're going to see a lot more people arriving soon.
Yeah, and I know that there's going to be a lot of people listening in to the oral argument. I'll certainly be one of them, and then we will break it down here at AFR tomorrow morning as well in terms of what actually happened in the oral argument. And so overall, you know, there are a lot of people on both sides, obviously, who have a vested interest in the outcome of this case. Given the composition of the Supreme Court, what are you expecting to hear in terms of some of the justices' questions today?
Well, it's so hard to predict how the justices will behave in these scenarios, but what I can say is that I've talked to a lot of legal experts who are on the right when this comes to this topic, and they're telling me it's not looking good for the pro-trans advocates. They don't think that their arguments hold much water, and they don't think that the justices are going to be very predisposed to side with them, but I guess that remains to be seen, right?
Right. Yeah. Then it's always interesting and fascinating to me to listen to some of these oral arguments and to see kind of what the justices focus on. Sometimes they focus on something, you know, very nuanced that that I didn't really think that they would, or that, you know, isn't really being focused on mainstream. But ultimately, hopefully, we hear some good questions that give us an indication that they are going to protect children, because this is going to have hopefully an impact. And, you know, the other thing that I was speaking to Abe Hamilton about earlier, Mary Margaret, was, you know, if we get to the Supreme Court saying, you know, yeah, of course, states have the right to impose these types of laws, this is the Supreme Court saying that. And, you know, I don't think that should be the Supreme Court saying that anyway. Clearly, this is a state level issue. And, you know, it doesn't really fall under the whole equal protection nonsense that they're describing. But, you know, for where conservatives are sitting, can this lead potentially to even more of a return to federalism? I mean, is that being discussed, you know, in your circles and what you've been hearing in terms of the reports of just the arguments in this case?
Well, I do know that Matt Walsh has said that he would love to see a federal ban on these procedures for kids. And what interestingly, Trump has floated that before. He kind of seems to have walked it back just a little bit and recently said at a rally that he would ban these procedures for kids without parental permission, which obviously would be a great thing. But I think, you know, not as strong as banning these procedures for kids across the board until they're 18. We're hearing those types of things floated. But in general, you know, Matt Walsh has been really strong on calling for a federal ban on this. I've heard similar sentiments from a lot of right-wing activists on Capitol Hill, right-wing lawmakers, but I guess we'll have to see how things play out during the Trump administration.
Yeah, and that'll be very interesting to see what they focus on. But Mary Margaret, we'll let you go now and get back to the reporting on Capitol Hill, and we'll be very interested to hear your take on it later. And I would love to see a federal ban on this. I think that the Congress, the incoming Congress that will be Republican-controlled, should focus on common-sense things like this. But certainly the states absolutely have the power to protect children and their own state citizens. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we'll turn to a couple of other headlines, but definitely tune in to the Supreme Court today for that really important case. But this coming from the Wall Street Journal, Donald Trump talks to Ron DeSantis about replacing Pete Hegseth. This is coming from the Wall Street Journal and has already gotten a lot of different response. Some reporters are suggesting that this is just the Wall Street Journal talking and there is nothing to back this up. Well, you know, some other sources are confirming this. And my personal opinion on this is I support Pete Hegseth. I don't think that allegations and bad headlines should ruin a nomination. But ultimately, the prerogative belongs to Trump to choose his cabinet positions. And if he doesn't want to expend the political capital on what may be a difficult confirmation, just because senators do have to give advice and consent, and they can do that based on whatever merit they choose, then he may decide to pull Pete. And that is his prerogative as well. And if a Governor DeSantis were to be the nominee, and if these reports are true that he's talking about it, I actually think that would be a great position for Governor DeSantis. I would have supported him for attorney general, but the SecDef position is the most powerful position in the president's cabinet. It would set him up very well for 2028. And would position him, I think, in a spot that he could use his strategic prowess and expertise in a way that would be very beneficial to the Trump administration. And for everybody who's suggesting that, you know, oh, the DeSantis supporters and the governor himself and the Trump supporters are all at odds or whatever, that is so false and not true. I mean, you know, people are allowed to run in primaries, as we've talked about. And Governor DeSantis running, just like a lot of other people did, once he withdrew, he immediately endorsed and supported Donald Trump and has continued that. And they're friends. They talk. And that's politics. And it's fine. So I would not be surprised if this headline is accurate. And we will see what ultimately happens. But let's turn to another story as well out of New York. The Daniel Penny case has now been brought to the jury. So they are in deliberations. And my good friend Eric Metaxas, who is an author and the host of the Eric Metaxas Show and one of my very dear friends, joins me now. So Eric, before we get to your new book, which I really want to hear about, I want to get your thoughts as a New Yorker on this case. And good morning.
Hey, good morning, Jenna. Thanks for having me. Yes, I'm in New York. You can hear the jackhammers out there. It's better than sirens. Good things are happening. New York, listen, I grew up in New York. I've lived in New York as an adult for a long time. When you hear about the details of the Penny situation, there is no doubt that people hope and pray that there would be somebody like that in the subway car if something like what happened happens. And the testimony from a number of people there, whatever, you're scared to death. When somebody acts like that, they put themselves in harm's way. He could have been shot by a cop. Anything could have happened. The point is, we have really lunatic leftist prosecutors. And I remember this goes back to the 60s and the 70s. They're lunatic leftists who somehow do not understand or care about the common man. It's one thing to care about criminals. We should care about them. We should treat them as human beings. We should worry that they're treated correctly. That is vital to law and order. But equally vital is understanding the people who have to deal with the crime. And so to me, from what I've heard, probably the case should be dismissed because the prosecutor seems unhinged and unfair. But that's another story.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with you more, Eric, that, you know, this case, and of course, this is about the former veteran who was on the subway, and you know, this homeless person came on and was threatening people and threatening to kill himself, and so Daniel Penny took him into the chokehold, and there are conflicting reports that came out at trial in terms of what this homeless person actually passed away from, whether that was actually due to the chokehold or that was just an aggravating factor. But all of that came out. But ultimately, I think you're right that New York seems to be more interested in prosecuting someone who was actually, in my opinion, protecting everyone on the subway. And I've been on the New York subway. It's kind of a scary place.
Yeah. By the way, I don't think of the New York subway as a scary place at all. But when
you're a
someone
New Yorker
like this comes on, you get out of the way and you realize they're crazy. And in this case, he seems particularly crazy. But what people aren't saying, Jenna, is Daniel Penny did not have to do this. Why did he do this? It's just like people who put themselves in danger for others. Why don't we applaud that? And if something goes wrong, yes, that's a tragedy. That's horrible. But he didn't need to do this. You know, like he actually puts himself in danger, puts himself out there, and of course puts himself in danger of being prosecuted and incarcerated. He did all that for all the strangers on the subway.
Yeah.
I mean, why aren't we applauding that, right?
We should.
It's kind of.
Absolutely, we should. We should be applauding when people are actually protecting their fellow man instead of prosecuting them. And meanwhile, New York isn't taking care of all of the illegal aliens that are there and some of the violent criminals. I mean, we see how many of those people have been just let go or they're not even arrested after, they're given this very meager bail. And so they're out and free to roam the streets again. I mean, these types of instances are where a lot of people don't have faith and confidence in our law enforcement anymore. So let's pray for a good outcome and an actually just outcome to that trial that I don't think should have even been brought to begin with. But Eric, let's turn to your book. So Socrates in the City is a phenomenal an organization that you helm. And I've been to some of these events that you hold, Socrates in the City, that are just excellent conversations that you moderate. And so this book's Conversations on the Examined Life. What is this book all about?
Well, it's the first Socrates in the City book we're publishing it ourselves. They're gorgeous, gorgeous books. I mean, I'm looking at a copy right now. They're just beautiful books, but they're also very readable. Now, what is it? I'll just say in a nutshell. I started Socrates in the City almost 25 years ago. Shocking. I said, listen, as a Christian, in places like New York, people tend not to ask the big questions. They don't talk about the meaning of life. If you think about truth and the meaning of life, or does life have meaning, or is there a God, those questions, if you really start to look into them, will draw you toward God. And I said, we need to have a place where we can have, you know, brilliant people who've written amazing books, but who also are great communicators, where I will interview them on the big questions. And we have had some of the most amazing conversations ever. I mean, I cannot exaggerate. Absolutely amazing, brilliant, beautiful, moving, interesting conversations. And I said, we need to take the best of these. I will edit them and put them in a book so that people can read these. Now, people can go to SocratesInTheCity.com and watch them online. They're gorgeously filmed, you know. I mean, it's all free. It's all at SocratesInTheCity.com. But I said it's time for us to do a book. And once a year, and this is the first one, we're going to publish a book, and it's a beautiful book. But the conversations, I edited them, and these are the best of the best. And I just keep saying, if you, let's say you have a friend or a relative, and you want to lead them in the direction of God or to think about this stuff. You know, if you give them a Jesus book, they might just sneer and go like, I'm not into that. But to get them thinking about the big questions, that's a way to do that. And so that's why we've done Socrates in the City. And that's, to my mind, the hope for the book, that you put it in somebody's hands, they're going to go, what is this? And they go, oh, there's a conversation here with a 91-year-old, a woman, Alice von Hildebrand. There's a conversation with Dick Cavett talking about fame and celebrity and the ups and the downs of the people that he's met. There's a conversation with Charlie Duke, who walked on the moon. He walked on the moon in 1972, and he comes back from the moon, and his life falls apart because he has done everything you could ever hope to do. His life has no meaning. He gets depressed. His marriage is falling apart, and he turns to God. And it is one of the most amazing stories, that he walked on the moon. That whole story, walking on the moon, it's insane. It's one of the most amazing conversations I've ever had. But then at the end, when I ask what happened after that, it's even more amazing. So this is, they're just beautiful conversations, and people can find them at Socrates in the City. ericmetaxas.com. All the books are there. This book is there. We're at my website, ericmetaxas.com. But I wanted to talk also about the Bonhoeffer movie, if we have a moment, just because we've got
Absolutely.
Two huge happening at once.
Go ahead. I mean, I'm so excited to see the movie. I haven't yet, but I'm excited.
This is what I'm saying to all my friends. You got to see it this week, because the lunatic left, I've never seen anything like it. The progressive Christians, absolute lunatics, have been attacking it, have been saying that, oh, it's a threat of Christian nationalism, like really insane, because the film is one of the greatest films you'll ever see in the theater. It is pointing to God. It is a faith film, but it's a mainstream film. I mean, people who have worked closely with Clint Eastwood, Mel Gibson, and on and on and on have made this film. So this is a $30 million gorgeous film like Chariots of Fire. It's just a great historical epic film. And a lot of my friends haven't seen it yet. They kind of think, oh, it'll be around. It won't, because theaters, if in 3 weeks, you know, you're not putting up gigantic numbers, they're like, next, we're going to put in another Disney screen, you know, another, we're going to put Disney or whatever on another screen because we just want money. So I'm telling people, this is a film. It's just like the Socrates in the City book. If you bring somebody who's not on the same page as you are politically or theologically, they will be drawn to think about the big questions in the most beautiful way. It's an evangelistic opportunity. Both of these things, to my mind, are evangelistic opportunities. When I wrote my Bonhoeffer book, it's the same thing. You are dealing with something that your average person can't help but be moved and inspired and provoked to think deeply about the big questions. And so to me, this film is such an opportunity, and I beg people to see it this week or this weekend at the latest, because it will go away. And we don't get an opportunity in the culture. I mean, literally, I can't think of a film in since Chariots of Fire that is a mainstream, huge film that is 100% pointing to God. God is at the center. That doesn't happen usually. Usually, you know, we have these little Christian films, but this is a film for everybody. You can take, you know, your liberal cousin or neighbor, and they're going to love it. It's just, it's like a film for everybody, but it points absolutely unequivocally to God. And I am so amazed. It took 12 years to make the film. And wow. I just want to get the word out desperately, because I know a lot of people are thinking, oh, it'll be around or maybe. And it's like, you don't want to wait. And you got to see it in the big theater. This is one of those films you got to see in the big theater.
Yeah, and this is done by Angel Studios, and so, you know, listeners will readily recognize, you know, what a great group that is, and some of the other, you know, powerhouse films that do point back to God. And this is where, Eric, a lot of your work and unfortunately, very few others. I wish that we could replicate you know, 100,000 times in the culture and in the media, because what you rightly describe as doing here is taking something that is a very powerful, true, moving story that is focused on God, but it's not one of these sort of, you know, let's just be honest, like B or C grade kind of tacky Christian films that are,
populated by people
oozy.
Who are just laid off from the Hallmark Channel.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's something that people want to go see because it has a very human, true component, but the message is one of a powerful, truthful gospel of Christ presentation that's weaved in. And so, when theaters have something like this, if they don't sell out theaters, then they start to go less and less. And so if you can, you know, bring your family. Is this something that, you know, what kind of age group in terms of families would this be appropriate for?
That's what's amazing. I mean, I would say, you know, even a young teenager, 13, would be fine, probably 12. I mean, this is like it's a family film, but it's not like saccharine. It's powerful. I mean, people are weeping at the end. And I want to say again, it is a big film. It's not like, you know, it's a little film and it kind of, you know, ticks the right boxes. No, this is a film that, you know, if the world weren't woke and insane, it would get Oscar nominations. The performances are amazing.
Well, you always have all the nominations from me, for what it's worth. And so, Eric Metaxas, love and appreciate you, my friend. Go see Bonhoeffer this week and this weekend. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.